From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
What it's really about at the end of the day is trying to make the funniest show you humanly can and not caring.
You know, now you walk into a room and you insist that, you know, you can't possibly take this note because it's a terrible note. And oh, by the way, did I tell you I'm the angriest man in television?
When it's going well, you assume that outcome is fair. But of course, everyone over the age of 12 knows that's not the case.
The box set had, you know, written in big, like, Sharpie on the side, Stevie Spielberg.
Sometimes guests give us such great interviews that we can't fit everything into one show. This week, we give you stuff that we saved from the cutting room floor. Veep showrunner David Mandel tells us what Larry David taught him about sitcom writing. David Simon, co-creator of The Deuce, explains why being labeled an SOB while writing The Wire worked to his advantage. Director and producer Sean Levy clears up what went wrong with his movie, Real Steel. And Matt Reeves, director of the most recent Planet of the Apes movies and the next Batman film, shares the crazy, fateful story of how he and J.J. Abrams got hired as teens to repair a famous director's very first movies. But first on the news banter, Hurricane Harvey. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, wow, this has been an extraordinary time in Hollywood. The Harvey Weinstein story is actually not just a national story. I've been on TV in Australia and interviewed in Britain. This is a huge story. Harvey has been fired over the weekend from his company. What the Weinstein Company is going to do or be without him is far from clear. The question I get asked most now by people calling me is this going to change things? Is this a pivotal moment in Hollywood at all?
I think the answer to that question is yes, it's a pivotal moment, but I don't know how much it's going to change. And I'm curious your thoughts on this, because I think that the fact that we are here, that women felt comfortable enough to come forward and make these allegations in the New York Times, where an actress like Ashley Judd said that she was made to watch Harvey Weinstein in the shower, she was subjected to unwanted advances about massages, and then other people corroborated her. The former president of Miramax, Mark Gill, went on the record and said this was a problem at Miramax when he was there. There was an internal HR document that was leaked that had all sorts of allegations about the treatment of a female employee. All of this stuff, it's not an accident that this is happening now. I believe the culture has changed to the point where we are post Bill Cosby, we are post Fox News, and women are feeling like they can come forward more than they have in the past. Will that translate to better behavior in Hollywood? I don't know.
I don't either, because women are so underrepresented, you know, in front of the camera, in decent roles, behind the camera, in the executive suites above all, I think, in this context. And as long as the balance of power is that out of whack, as long as there are a big concentration of men who have lots and lots of money, and, you know, when you think about what Harvey could have implicitly on offer with these women. He was an awards magnate. He could put you in a movie. He could potentially get you nominated, even get you a win, which we are told actually happened in the case of one particular actress whose name has not so far been in the mix. So that still is a thing. There are still men who can say, I can give you this, that, and the other thing. Now, turning to that memo that you mentioned, I mean, I somewhat suspect that that memo is the wedge that was used to crack this story open finally, because as I have written in The Hollywood Reporter, I tried to do this for years. We tried to do this for years. We came close, but we couldn't get anybody on the record, and we weren't obviously not the only ones. That memo is a piece of paper. People could go to women with that and say, we have this now. This is going to be on the record. So if you come forward, we'll make sure you're not alone. We'll make sure there are others. And, you know, with the things that we would have to do in the media to make people willing to do this. And, you know, the irony may be that memo may have come from inside the Weinstein Company. Somebody may have leaked it to bring Harvey down.
Who knows? There was even speculation that his brother Bob may have been behind it. They were fed up with him. The point is, we don't know. But the fact is that memo did come out. And there are probably others, and not just at the Weinstein Company. is this going to be a waterfall that causes all sorts of documents and testimony to come forward? I moderated a roundtable with Amy Pascal this past weekend, who is in a unique position because she's the former head of Sony Pictures and is now a producer. And I asked her point blank, I said, is Harvey an outlier? Because he said, I'm a dinosaur. I came of age in the 60s
yes,
and 70s.
World's most not useful excuse.
Right, which John Oliver pointed out that your excuse is not an excuse right. at all. And I asked Amy, I said, is he an outlier? And she said, absolutely not. He's not an outlier. And this behavior still does go on.
I think the behavior goes on. I have to think Harvey is somewhat of an outlier in terms of the aggression and physical aggressiveness that he used. He's a big, intimidating guy. And from what I've heard, and some of this may yet be revealed, you know, he was very physically aggressive. And I think we would hear that if that were a pattern. But having said that, my phone has been ringing and people are saying, check out this person, check out that person. We're talking about people at the pinnacle of power in Hollywood. I mean, we have to be careful in the media because, you know, there could be almost like a McCarthy-like moment to, you know, who did you harass and who did you assault and what did you do? Having said that, I think there's a lot of men in this town that are pretty nervous right now and for good reason.
Absolutely. But you mentioned the legal aspect and the media and the law are very intertwined in this area because people are asking, oh, well, why didn't the media go after Harvey? Why didn't the media do this and this? But there is a legal framework in which you are exposed if you go forward with a story that does not have an on-the-record source. And I think that that is used to advantage by people in Harvey Weinstein's position because he had very aggressive lawyers over the years. He had Burt Fields, he had David Boies, perhaps the most high-priced litigators in Los Angeles and New York, respectively. He had Charles Harder, who has made a cottage industry career after going after media outlets. And you have to have the goods if you want to go up against these guys. And in this case, the Times had the goods.
And we've seen a couple of instances where people have said they're going to sue, even though they have the goods. I mean, Eric Bolling from Fox News, ex-Fox News now, threatened, I don't know if he's actually filed, threatened to sue a reporter who wrote about him sending unwanted sexual texts to people. And we've seen Harvey threaten that he's going to sue the New York Times, you know.
Do you think that suit will ever be filed?
I do not, because Harvey is a public figure. First of all, how could he possibly withstand discovery? If he sues, the door is wide open to start calling all sorts of people and having them testify under oath.
No, and as we noted this weekend in a very interesting legal analysis, a lawsuit against the New York Times could possibly open the door to women who signed non-disclosure agreements being freed in order to testify in that lawsuit, which could really open the floodgates.
Exactly. And the other factor is that Harvey is a public figure, and therefore they would have to prove malice or recklessness on the part of the New York Times. They're never going to get there. So, you know, I think these threats, but the other side of that coin is they can file anyway. I mean, I don't think Harvey will. And they can try to bleed an outlet to death, even if there's no basis for the claim, because news outlets are under fire and it's tough to fend these things off. So we're at a moment now where we're going to have to figure out, how are we reporting these stories? When can we get these things on the record? I mean, ironically, somebody called me this morning to say, there is this person and that person, but I'm off the record. And I'm like, okay, that's so helpful. Thank you very much. You know, it's very frustrating. And it was with Harvey for years.
I agree.
So now there's this company left over, the Weinstein Company, which I had said in previous interviews, and now it appears that I was correct. They will be looking to change that name. That name is very toxic right now. Harvey's name is being taken off of all sorts of projects. Can that be a thing, or do they end up having to sell?
I don't know. I think the next month or so will be key in determining whether the Weinstein Company can outlive Harvey. They do have, you know, 7 or 8 movies that are set up either in the can or in production. They have a TV business that, you know, is they do have projects that are going to appear on the Paramount Network and on Amazon and a couple others. So there is a business there. It's been a business that has struggled over the past few years. But if you talk to people at the Weinstein Company, they believe that they can outlive Harvey.
Well, this outcome, I will say, is certainly richly deserved, in my opinion. But it's hard to imagine Harvey without Hollywood and Hollywood without Harvey. He has been a fixture in this town for 30 years, or the better part of 30 years. And this is the ignominious end of the Harvey era. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. We have interesting guests on the business, and sometimes our conversations are too long to fit into one show. So a few months ago, we decided to start saving some of the best stuff that didn't quite make the cut, and we knew we'd find a home for it. First up is writer-producer David Mandel, the showrunner of HBO's Veep, which just won another Emmy for Outstanding Comedy Series. Mandel got his start writing for Saturday Night Live and then joined two college friends, Alec Berg and Jeff Schaefer, working on Seinfeld, and then Curb Your Enthusiasm. Mandel credits Larry David with sharpening his comedy skills and for being a big part of the reason he was chosen to take over as the showrunner of Veep in season 5, following the departure of series creator Armando Iannucci.
I do think a lot of it came from the HBO side. Casey Bloys, who at the time was the head of comedy but is now the head of all of HBO, you know, he was there for all of the Curb stuff or a lot of the Curb stuff. I think
right.
Originally it was Sue Nagel, but then Casey Bloys was sort of there for that. And as I said, I worked with Jeff and Alec. And then Alec, when they were, I think, they had shot a pilot of Silicon Valley but then wanted to do reshoots and make some changes. Alec sort of was drafted out of the Curb guys and went off and did that.
Yes.
And that led to, that was a very successful sort of deploying of the Curb boys, who, of course, were not making Curb anymore. And so I think because that had worked, he just kind of went sort of back to the bench, if you will, and sort of was like, well, who else do I have?
Right,
and
right.
It was sort of, you know, so I think it kind of came from sort of, you know, at the end of the day, it's the training that really Larry sort of imparted in us, you know, and I think that that sort
of. Is there a way to summarize that training?
For me, you know, I always say very specifically, Larry, and I think Alec and Jeff would say the same, Larry has really taught us to write sitcoms. And I think it's first of all, it's outline, 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 structure, structure, structure. Even on Curb, where we don't write scripts, we have very full outlines where nothing is left to chance. Dialogue is left to chance. Comedy can comedy can come out of those words. But even those words, there are specific things that we know have to happen in the scenes, either specific lines or pieces of information or sometimes even jokes.
Like Larry has to lose his notebook.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, these things have to happen. But structurally, because I guess a lot of times, yes, there are funny lines both in Seinfeld and in Curb. But when you actually think about those shows, it's usually like some kind of combination of moments that people remember. Like, you know, they like, yeah, they'll quote Seinfeld, but they'll, you know, or Kerr, but they'll, it's also like, oh my God, that moment when, you know
the
what I mean?
Survivor
yes.
moment.
You see this glass eye?
Have you even seen the show?
Did you ever see our show? It was called the Holocaust.
Look, all I know is I was damn close to that $1 million, all right? And the whole time, everyone's backstabbing me and undermining me, trying to get me kicked off the show.
You
don't aggravate
know
yourself
nothing
here.
About survival. I'm a survivor.
I'm a survivor.
I'm a survivor.
I'm a survivor.
Like that.
No, exactly,
will never die
exactly. And it's
me.
Hilarious. But what you really remember is that misunderstanding and how it came together. And that's structure. And it's structure, it's keeping things moving. It's every scene has a reason. Every scene advances the various plots. There's no scenes that exist unto themselves. If a scene is just sitting there, you're going to lose that scene. And that honestly, even when you're editing, you can lose a joke to keep a scene because it's about what happens in the scene more than any one joke. And that's certainly a lot of sort of like a lot of the writing lessons. And then a certain sort of, I don't know, I guess I'll say comedy ethics in terms of not caring about what so many like shows waste their time on about like, oh, I don't like how my guy looks, or that seems mean, or that's not nice, or any of that kind of stuff. And I obviously people talk about like the Seinfeld stuff about how it's like about nothing and there's no learning and no hugging. And those are nice ways of saying it. But what it's really about at the end of the day is trying to make the funniest f-ing show you humanly can and not caring. And not caring if someone's going to be offended, not caring if someone's going to be bothered about it, not caring that especially in the case of Larry, and this is true with Julia, and this is why I think it works, is Julia is willing to look ugly on camera. Julia is willing to look both, you know, to be the bad guy on camera. And she's then willing to sort of take her lumps for Selena to be punished and be dumped upon. And again, these are very similar things. Even though Curb and Veep are very different shows, there's a DNA there that's very similar. And so that's sort of the other thing I think Larry sort of imparted, you know, sort of on those of us that were lucky enough. You know, I sometimes joke, And the other part of my training was sort of the SNL stuff, which is I was lucky enough there to work with Al Franken, now Senator Al Franken, who brought me into the show and was very much a mentor to me. And then Jim Downey, the longtime executive producer and head writer of both Saturday Night Live, but also Letterman in the early days, who I think really has defined a lot of what is comedy without a lot of people necessarily knowing who he is. And what I was going to simply say is both from those guys, the sort of Jim Downey and then also sort of Larry, and by the way, they both respect each other very much, you almost get like sort of like coaching trees like you do in the NFL of sort of like, you know, we are the disciples of this, and then you hope that you're kind of taking their teachings and moving forward. And so those are the guys that really, you know, really taught me.
That was David Mandel, the showrunner of Veep on HBO. David Simon, creator of the immortal series The Wire and co-creator of The Deuce, is another member of the HBO family. When we sat down with him over the summer, AMC had just made public a trove of rage-filled and profanity-laced emails that Frank Darabont, the creator of The Walking Dead series, had sent to associates during the show's first season. AMC fired Darabont, even though The Walking Dead was a huge hit. Darabont and his agents at CAA subsequently sued over profits. The cable channel submitted the emails to the court to depict Darabont as someone who had to be fired. I asked David Simon about his response to that drama. I saw you tweeted when the emails came out in the Walking Dead lawsuit and the rants of Frank Darabont were revealed.
Yeah.
And you said, I'm no longer the worst. Did you see yourself in that?
No, I'm playing with imagery. I became a son of a bitch overnight. It was the last season of The Wire. We were doing stuff about the media. And I had been sort of open about, you know, what I thought happened to my newspaper and what out-of-town ownership did.
Obviously,
and
the Baltimore Sun.
Yeah, I used to work at the Baltimore Sun. And I have very strong feelings about what happened to journalism. And some of that was going to be conveyed in season 5 of The Wire. But there was a piece written in advance of that that was almost prophylactic in trying to prevent my relationship with my old editors. Somebody who had worked with them for years wrote an advance piece about how malevolent I was, mm-hmm. and that I carried these grandiose grudges. And it was all sour grapes. And, you know, my reply was, listen, you know, if you saw what happened to my newspaper, it's not sour grapes. It's more like spoiled roast, you know. But you don't write anything to grind on one or two guys. I mean, you know, that's not enough to sustain you in something like, a television show that takes a 2 years to execute any single season. So I thought it was silly. But suddenly, like, the piece was about how I was the angriest man in television. And at first, I was sort of like, I'm not that, you know, come on. I've been working with the same people for 20 years. I mean, you don't stay at one network if you're throwing hand grenades all the time. Every now and then, you got to throw a firecracker or two. But, you know, I'm not blowing things up left and right. And the people who work for me are the same people who work for me. So I'm looking at this. I'm thinking, I'm the angriest guy in television. But after a while, I kind of liked it. It was like, you know, now you walk into a room and you insist that, you know, you can't possibly take this note because it's a terrible note. And, oh, by the way, did I tell you I'm the angriest man in television? So at a certain point, I sort of like wrapped it around me like, well, this is fun to wear for certain occasions.
Right.
You know, can't wear it out everywhere. Don't want to wear it in front of my crew, but I'll wear it, you know, walking.
Once in a while, I can be that
guy. Not so bad. So that became kind of a joke. But when I saw those emails, listen, anything he wants to yell or anybody, I don't know Mr. Dagrafon. I don't want to single him out. Anything you want to yell upwards at a network and try to get away with, go with God, you know? I mean, like, who cares? You know, they can't be hurt. If their feelings are hurt, that's their job, you know? You're trying to make your version of what you think the television show should be. Have your arguments. It's the sort of yelling down at DPs and
kick
directors.
Kick up, kick down.
Yeah, exactly. That's the part where, like, I'm sorry, you know, it's hard. The crew works their ass off. And even if they don't execute in the way you think in a given moment, you know, tomorrow's another day and everybody comes to work wanting to be part of a collective. You know, film is one of the most collaborative things I've ever been involved with. So that's how I felt about that.
That was David Simon, co-creator of The Deuce on HBO. Coming up after a short break, director Sean Levy defends Real Steel and blames the marketing. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Today, we're sharing some stories from recent guests that we cut very reluctantly from previous shows. When filmmaker Sean Levy, known for the Night at the Museum movies, stopped by the studio earlier this summer, he told us about establishing himself as a producer of note with the Oscar-nominated Arrival and the Netflix hit Stranger Things, which returns this month for season two. Levy also talked about his 2011 movie Real Steel, which starred Hugh Jackman. The film is set in 2020 in a world where robots have taken the place of humans in the boxing ring.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Real Steel?
The film made almost $300 million at the box office worldwide, but it was still considered a disappointment. Many critics didn't know what to make of it. I mean, you had this recent success, which makes me feel comfortable asking about painful failure, which leads me to Real Steel. That was a big heartbreak.
You know what? It's very interesting, Kim, because Real Steel ultimately, first of all, Real Steel was the beginning of what has become one of my most precious friendships, which is with Hugh. And honestly, the experience of working with Steven Spielberg,
Hugh Jackman, and Steven Spielberg.
It was incredible. Oh, I'm so sorry. That was so obnoxious. Hugh Jackman and Steven Spielberg. So not only a great experience, but that movie ultimately, I mean, and this is kind of little known, but the movie ended up making like $320 million worldwide. And I do realize that
it's one of those frustrating ones.
Like we always felt, we still feel.
Right.
The Real Steel, like that movie tested like I've never seen a movie. It was so crowd-pleasing. And the reviews were pretty good. And yet we allowed it to be marketed. Two critical mistakes. A, we rated it PG-13 and there was no reason for that. That was a family film in the shell of a robot boxing movie. And that movie really should have been presented for what it was, which was an emotional, often sentimental, rousing father-son sports movie.
It was, but that is PG-13.
You know what? It really probably could have been PG because these are robots
hitting
each other.
Isn't that kind of the kiss of death in a way?
That was the thinking. But in the end, I think it was a combination of the fact that Real Steel was PG-13 and marketed like Transformers Light. And if people want Transformers, they're going to go see Transformers. There's a new one every few years. Right. You just wait a bit. There's another one coming.
Now there's going to be a world.
Exactly. Now there's going to be a world. So for me and for all of us, including Steven Spielberg and Stacey Snyder, who was, you know, running DreamWorks at that moment, Real Steel is this kind of beloved movie that did pretty well, but nowhere near as well as we would have liked. And that was probably one of the times that I learned a lesson that you kind of have to keep learning in this business, which is when – like I made like something like seven movies in a row that were hits. And when it's going well, you assume that outcome is fair. You assume that life is fair. But of course, everyone over the age of 12 knows that's not the case. But I somehow always forget that in the end, in this movie business, you don't control outcome. It isn't necessarily connected and reciprocal to the quality of the work. There's marketplace, there's cultural shifts, there's timing, there's competitive movies on the same weekend. There's so many factors. And that was a big lesson for me. And I've had it a few times of you better pick the movie for the right reason because you can't control the outcome.
That was filmmaker Sean Levy. Finally, a little reminiscence from Matt Reeves, director of the two most recent Planet of the Apes movies and the next Batman movie. It's another story in which Steven Spielberg plays a role. Reeves is a childhood friend of J.J. Abrams, who is now directing his second Star Wars film. Reeves remembers when he and Abrams, at 15 years old, found themselves presented with a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
So J.J. and I met because we both made 8mm movies, and in L.A., there was Theta Cablevision, and it had the Z channel, but it also had public access, Channel 3, and you could rent out that time for – the public could rent it out for a show. So this guy who did these short films, and he was like, oh, I want to do like a showcase for amateur 8mm filmmakers, and most of them were kids.
And the Z Channel, of course, is a legend of early cable that brought quality film.
And showed like director's cuts of movies,
right,
and was like,
right.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I remember that vividly. Like that was that was an exciting time as a kid to be watching these movies and just seeing all those, you know, movies that otherwise you wouldn't ever get to see on TV.
People did. I mean, he got noticed for things that would have never been noticed otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so on the Public Access Channel, which was a collection of the strangest programming you'd ever seen in your life, here were these 8mm movies, and I saw this kid who was my age, and he was showing his movies, a horror movie called The Attic, and it was JJ. And so I called up the number afterwards, and I said, can I get my movies on this channel? And the guy said, oh, yeah, absolutely. And he goes, I should introduce you to JJ. You guys are the same age. And so we became friends, and that guy, his name was Gerard Revelle, he started a festival of all, because he got so many, Larry Fong, who's a wonderful DP, he had a short film called Toast Encounters of the Burnt Kind, which was really good and had all these effects for an 8mm
movie. Worth it for the title alone?
Yes,
yeah.
It certainly was. It was really funny. And he was like, wow, I could put together a film festival. So we had a one night only showing at the New Art Theater that was written up on the cover of the calendar section of the LA Times. The article was like Beardless Wonders, and it was me, JJ, and a friend of mine, Mark Sanderson, and Gerard. And Steven saw the article and was like, oh, I want to see these movies. And we literally got a phone call that was like, hey, you know, Steven, it was from Kathy, and she said, Steven wants to see the movies because he made 8mm movies when he was a kid. So 6 months later, I got a phone call from Kathy Kennedy,
who
again,
now, I should say, produced many films for Steven, but now runs Lucasfilm.
Yeah. And so she said, listen, I'm calling you because Steven just found in his house that he used to live in Arizona, in the basement, the people who live there now found a box. The box had, you know, written in big, like, Sharpie on the side, Stevie Spielberg. And inside were these reels of 8mm movies, which Steven had lost. He had no idea where all of his student films were, all the movies he made when he was, like, 14, 15 years old. And it had one was, like, Escape to Nowhere, which was, like, Raiders of the Lost Ark in a weird way, a movie called Firelight, which literally was a version of Close Encounters that he made as a kid. So she said, you know, they're all in disrepair. Steven said to me, can you get them repaired? And she goes, they're 8mm movies. How am I going to get them repaired? And he said, call those kids. And so she said, so would you be willing to, you know, we'd be willing to pay you. And so they paid JJ and I $250. And we went through and we re-spliced and put all, and what was amazing was we watched all the movies. And it was so, as a kid, you know, who idolized Steven Spielberg, for us to look at those movies was so exciting because they were like ours, like not particularly great. You know, you're like going there. By the way, I've seldom seen 8mm movies. It's not like now. Now you can literally take your iPhone and you can cut it on iMovie and you can do all this stuff. And I've seen stuff kids do. You're like, that looks professional quality. This is like held together splices, you know, people shot in their houses. And it was very encouraging. And so, yeah. So JJ, that's actually how the first time that I met Kathy Kennedy was when we were 15.
And so it began.
And so it began.
That was director Matt Reeves. He's going to direct the next Batman movie. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.